Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Deadly gun violence has been in the headlines for the District of Columbia nearly every day for the past several months. But there's so much more happening in the district. COVID infection concerns on the rise, police funding, taxes, and more. We're going to talk to D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson about all of that tonight. He joins us with his perspective. We want to hear from you as well. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Chairman Mendelson, thank you so much for joining the conversation. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you for inviting me, Harold. Good evening to everyone.
Let's get right to the issue at hand, deadly gun violence in the District of Columbia. At last count, 111 homicides in the district, gun violence appearing at least to be out of control, high-profile homicides in the district. From your perspective, what do you believe is the best way to get a handle on this?
Well, I think that smart policing could make a difference. And I don't mean in that a criticism of our MPD, but there's some things that we can be doing that might be a bit more proactive, using intelligence to intercede when we see that there's a gang that's shot at another gang or gang member, and then there's likely to be retaliation. This is a strategy that Kathy Lanier deployed when she became chief. I think it contributed to lowering the numbers. There's some strategies along those lines, focusing on known violent offenders, because they're the ones who are most likely to be not just shooting, but repeat shooting. So I call that smart policing. I also think that U.S. Attorney needs to be more aggressive about prosecuting homicide cases. Sometimes the U.S. Attorney doesn't get the best evidence, but sometimes U.S. Attorney is not as aggressive as I think needs to be the case to get these cases closed. Because in the end, getting a conviction is likely to lock up a repeat offender, because so much of gun violence is done by repeat offenders.
Do you believe that Chief Robert Conte's criticism of the judicial system, that you see some of the same people committing the same crimes back on the street once they've gone through the criminal justice system, is a valid concern?
I like Chief Conte, and I'm very hopeful. He's a new chief. I'm very hopeful that he's going to be very good. I think it's easy to point fingers. To be sure, there are instances where offenders were released when they should have been held, but there's several players to that. We'll begin with, what evidence do police have to sustain holding an individual? More importantly, is the U.S. Attorney as aggressive as the prosecutor's office needs to be to inform and persuade the court that the person is a danger to the community or a risk of flight? Because those are the standards for holding or not holding a person, as if they're a danger to the community or a risk of flight.
We are talking to D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson about all things D.C. tonight: crime, taxes, police, and several other issues. Lines are open. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll, of course, be taking those phone calls all the way up until 8 o'clock. So please give us a call if you have a comment or a question. One of the things, Mr. Chairman, that has come up just this week is that the mayor has given the chief the okay to use, paraphrasing here, as much money as necessary through overtime to get a handle on this gun violence situation. This is a change, apparently, from where we were last year as related to police funding. As you, I'm sure you remember very well, where the council cut some $15 million from the police budget, there's always been this discussion about moving the money around and changing the philosophy about how the police department is funded. Well, here we are a year later. What are your thoughts about where we are now as it relates to how the police department is funded?
Well, as you know, the phrase defund the police has different meanings to different people. I think we need to be careful with regard to how much we are cutting back on the police. The Police Reform Commission, which was a creation of the council, did not call for defunding the police. It called for decentering police.
That's why I didn't use the term defund, but please go right ahead.
Well, and the idea is that there's some things that maybe like a mental health professional would be better than a police officer in responding to an acute psychotic breakdown, which might be a barricade situation. Just as an example, the pendulum has moved in the direction of cutting back on the police. We've seen the police force reduce in size. That makes me nervous. And I think a lot of folks are not so much interested in seeing fewer police, but seeing better policing. Policing that's more sensitive to the community and less of, shall we say, an occupier. And I think that's important. But I got to tell you that more overtime, is, which I assume means more police out on the streets, is not the same as the police doing what needs to be done with evidence gathering and talking to witnesses to close cases. Last year, the closure rate for firearm homicides was 44%. 44%. That means over half of the homicides in which a gun was used are unsolved at this point. That's too low, because the way you turn the corner on violence is to what I call swift and certain justice, that you identify the perpetrators, get them to court as quickly as possible, and you get a conviction.
What do you believe is behind this apparent surge in deadly gun violence? Do you believe that it is the availability of guns? Do you believe that this is a social issue? Do you believe, as the chief has mentioned in one of his many press conferences over the past week or so, the proliferation of marijuana, even though it is, you know, recreationally legal? Or a combination of those or something else?
Well, if those are my choices, I would say probably social factors.
I just threw those out, but you may have your own ideas.
I understand. I don't think it is marijuana. Marijuana is not known to be a drug that induces violent behavior. I'm sorry, it just isn't. The phenomenon of gun violence in the city and the increase in homicides is not unique to the district. We're seeing it across the country. So there are factors at work that are broader than any one thing you can point to in the district. I know the police union wants to blame the council and some accountability provisions that we put in place. I don't think that's it. We were seeing that there was an increase in violent crime before the pandemic. So we can point to things like the emotional stress, the psycho-emotional stress that folks have been feeling with the pandemic and being shut in and higher unemployment. But as I said, the trend began before the pandemic. It's never really clear why on a national level violent crime is going up or going down. That, in my view, doesn't get us off the hook. As I said earlier, I think there are things that our police can be doing that would reduce the incidence of gun violence and violent crime. Smart policing.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to the chairman of the D.C. Council, Phil Mendelson. Kathy, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Well, good evening, Mr. Fisher. Good Hi. Evening, Chairman Kathy Henderson, 10-term ANC commissioner. You served as an ANC commissioner. I hope you're still as close to the community as I am. And I agree with you that the U.S. Attorney's Office needs to prosecute more aggressively and more quickly. But I would ask you and your colleagues to marshal the support on the council to introduce some emergency legislation to bring back some strong retirees that are loyal to the chief, Chief Conte and MPD, to help get this surge in violence down. And getting back to the closest on the in the community, the word on the streets is that people can do whatever they want, so they're doing just that. It's not the pandemic in full. It's the fact that we've been talking about how much we hate the police, criticizing the police, defund the police, and these people are out of control. We have officers that are going onto crime scenes and they are being attacked. That is just it's unprecedented, and it's because of the rhetoric. We have to change the narrative and we have to rein public safety back in. We need to protect our city.
Kathy, let me ask you, because this issue with the rhetoric and the like, that didn't happen overnight, as you know. And so
But it's been building momentum.
That's my point. And so I don't imagine that it's going to change right away. And I think, you know, the discussion about retired police officers, you know, returning to the force, I mean, we could do an entire show about that. But how do you balance returning the respect of the police department as a whole with, you know, with dealing with that, you know, with the criminal element? I mean, you've got respect, you've got fear, and then you've got working within the community. Am I making sense with my question? I hope that's too disjointed.
Let me kind of unpack what you put out there, and thank you so much
with that.
For your provocative questions, and I appreciate them. These are the types of discussions that we need to be having. What's happened, unfortunately, in the district is that our police department has been conflated with the national problem. Here, we have a very largely professional police department that's doing the hard work, and they have the respect of the community, and they're doing what needs to be done. But we keep hearing the steady drumbeat of, you know, what's happening elsewhere. The George Floyd situation that we all can agree is disgusting, and just a poor example of policing. That's not happening here. And the Justice Department came in back in, 2005, made some recommendations. MPD implemented them, and they are better for those implementations. And we need to continue to move forward. You know, we have a good reputation as a police department, and we need to build on that. But what's also happening is that people are seeing these tragedies on the news. Then you have our own chairman of the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety constantly, denouncing, criticizing, and deriding our officers. That's wrong. Mm. And it sends the wrong message to people that have no respect. And just one last point. This is, you can say this is anecdotal, but we had an officer last week. He saw an individual with marijuana, selling marijuana. He rightfully approached that individual. That individual attacked him, wrestled him to the ground, and thank God our officer was physically fit and well-trained enough to regain control of that situation, arrest that offender, which also included a gun. This type of aggressive assault on our officers is becoming too commonplace, and it has to stop. So when I talk about bringing back retired police officers. I'm only talking about on a temporary basis.
Okay.
You know, 90 days, 120 days. I mean, we have some good officers that are still on the force, but we need some help.
Okay.
We need some help.
Kathy, I need you to hang on. My producer needs to speak with you, and I also want the chairman to share his thoughts about what you said. So, Kathy, please hang on because she's going to pick up your line. Thank you so much for your thoughtful sharing and unpacking of my convoluted question. Mr. Chairman, your thoughts about what Kathy just shared with us.
Well, I agree with a lot of what she said. I don't think that's the whole story. There are some issues with the police morale here. We're seeing that across the country. Part of the challenge there is that what I have seen is that when there is an incident of police brutality, a racism in another jurisdiction, that a lot of people look to our police as if they're guilty. And, of course, it wasn't our department at all. There is room for improvement with our MPD. They are better trained, and that's good. That doesn't mean that there isn't room for improvement. I do think that the union overstates its criticisms. One thing that it doesn't like is accountability and some of the accountability mechanisms, like the legislation that actually I authored, the amendment a year ago that said the police can't bargain their disciplinary process.
Hmm.
You know, police have extraordinary powers, extraordinary. They're the only ones in our society who are legitimately allowed to deprive another individual of liberty and even life. And that's extraordinary. So they should be held to a higher standard in terms of accountability.
Okay.
And the police resent that. I think that's unfortunate because police who are doing their jobs and doing their jobs well are not going to be the ones who are caught in the crosshairs of a disciplinary process.
Mr. Chairman, I need to interrupt you for just a moment. I need to take a quick break. But T, calling from D.C., we're going to talk to you. Pam, also calling from D.C., we're going to catch your phone call. And Travis, calling from Hyattsville, we're going to talk to you as well. Please do not hang up. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM in just a few moments. Stretches in for John Mons with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking all things D.C. with D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson. We've got a lot of information to share with you tonight, and we're just really getting to the tip of the iceberg. We've got a lot of callers on the line, and I want to move quickly to some of the phone calls, and I want to make sure that I at least get to some of these other issues. Let me grab Travis, who has been waiting patiently from Hyattsville. Travis, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just called to share. I heard you say about the killings going on in D.C.
Yes, sir.
Recently, in the past couple of weeks, I'm sure everyone heard about the little girl that got killed.
Yes, sir.
On the corner of Martin Luther King and MLK. I'm 22 years old. I got two sons, 4 years old and 9 months old. And I just think about what would happen if one of my sons were to be in an accident like that. And I just can't even think about what I would do or where my mind would be. So I just trying to reach out to us as a human race, not as a black people, not as a white people, not as men, not as women, but as a human race, that we all have to come together. Not, you know what I'm saying? We all have to come together. We're all human. Not about color, not about where we come from, how much money we got, none of that. We're all human. We all deserve a chance. You know, our children deserve a chance.
Indeed. Travis, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. Continue to do the best you can in being a father. And we certainly salute you every day. Thank you so much. Let's go to Pam. Pam calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Pam. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'd like to comment about the importance of having mental health professionals on the scene with the police in order to contribute to diffusing a situation based on their education and clinical knowledge about what may be going on. I'm in the mental health field, and I recently came upon a scenario where a young man had taken his car and ran into a tree. And upon coming on the scene, I immediately was able to determine that PCP was involved. It has a certain distinctive smell, the way that people present, which is called PCP psychosis, is exactly, he was presenting textbook symptoms of someone who was under the influence of PCP. The police immediately became very aggressive in their handling of him. The ambulance drivers were on the scene, and I encouraged the ambulance drivers to intervene and assess this as a medical emergency and not a crime that had been committed. I mean, unfortunately, he had run into a tree, but he hadn't hurt anybody. He wasn't being aggressive to another human being or him. I guess he was actually a threat to himself. But unfortunately, well, fortunately, I was able to convince the medical personnel to step in and exercise their knowledge and authority in the situation, and that instead of them putting him into the police car, which they had initially done and handcuffed him, they put him into the ambulance and took him to the hospital. So I think that the importance of mental health professionals being able to be present and contribute to a scene such as that would allow both parties to be safe because of the knowledge that the mental health professionals bring to the situation.
Mr. Chairman, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that pilot program already underway in the district?
Well, there are several programs underway that would attempt to better respond to an incident such as what the caller identified. You know, we've come to think that the police, everything is, you know, all police, all times for everything. And that doesn't make sense when you think about it. And I think the caller illustrated a good example where a police response, particularly a hostile or aggressive police response, isn't necessary and is even inappropriate.
What she's speaking about, and this is what I was referring to, and my memory may fail me, but because there's been so much discussion about that, I seem to remember reading some news stories about in the district the hiring of mental health professionals to respond to situations in the district where there may be people in crisis who may first need to have the help of a mental health professional.
Some of that's been going on.
Yeah.
The mayor has in the budget an increase in staffing to the Department of Behavioral Health. We also, I think the council did this, put in the budget some money for diversion at the 911 call center. These are all strategies to try to put in place the recommendations of the Police Reform Commission to decenter police. The police don't have to respond every time to everything. That we would have mental health professionals, for example, respond when it appears that it's a mental health situation.
Okay.
So some of that's going on. And there's money in the budget and different initiatives to expand that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, people such as Pam, you know, need to know that these things are happening and these are, you know, great ideas. And these are progressive ideas, and that they are happening in the district, even if you may not know that they are happening. And I wanted to make sure that you were aware. So, Pam, thank you. Thank you so much. I do want to move to another issue before I go back to the phone, and that is the issue of taxes. And,
yes.
You know, last week, the council had had, there were discussions on the council about taxing, the wealthy, and the mayor says no. Can you kind of explain that? The mayor says that the coffers are flush, and she doesn't approve of that. Why? Where did the idea of taxing more wealthy residents come from? Is this a fair share kind of thing from your perspective? What?
Well, it's sort of a fair share thing. I did not support the tax increase, and I've been quite vocal in not supporting it. There's a time to be raising taxes, but when our budget is infused with about $3 billion of federal money for next year or for the next couple of years, why we're raising taxes when we've gotten this much additional money? Our local revenues are up higher, in fact, the economy is turning around. So why are we raising taxes when our revenues are already substantially higher for next year? We had a hearing on June 25th. I chaired the hearing because I chair the committee of the whole, and there were a substantial number of individuals, I would say almost all of them affiliated with very left-of-center groups who were advocating for raising taxes, and they gave different reasons. One of them was that, the federal money will run out, to which I was thinking, well, then why don't we wait until a couple years from now or next year when we're closer to the federal money running out, but that's not a reason to do it now. And there were other witnesses who said that we need more revenue. Well, we have more revenue, so that wasn't exactly persuasive. All this was kind of driven home for me when the council members who submitted the amendment waited until the night before to explain what the money would be used for. And the money was proposed to be used for good causes. And I made a speech that said that the people, and there were five council members, a little over a third of the council that voted no, and I made a speech that said, look, just because somebody's voting against a tax increase doesn't mean that they oppose the purposes for which the money will be spent, like child care, improving wages for child care workers, or expanding our earned income tax credit program. But I have to say, the proponents of the tax increases were looking for a reason to raise taxes, we're looking for a way to spend the taxes, and didn't identify a proposal until the night before the vote. I think it was a mistake to do this. Most of the witnesses who testified who said, oh, no, we absolutely should raise taxes, and I completely support it, and I would pay for it, but almost every one of them won't have to pay higher taxes. It's raising taxes to be paid by others. If one makes the argument that wealthy people should pay a higher percentage of their income on taxes, they already do that in our income tax. Our income tax is the most progressive in the country. The wealthiest pay the most as a percentage of their income. The lowest income pay the least. In fact, we have an earned income tax credit, which means that they get a refund, even if they don't pay taxes. So we're quite progressive. I think it was a bad idea. I gave more of an answer than you were looking for, Harold. But,
no, not necessarily.
I hope I covered what you wanted.
No, and and I don't live in the district, but I've got a, because the coffers are flush, I've got a speed camera ticket I need to talk about. But
okay.
I could use that money more than the district, but that's another conversation. Let me go to T. Calling from the district. T, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a born and raised Washingtonian.
Yes, ma'am.
1971, and I am an ex-victim of gun violence. But I do know in the 80s, D.C. was able to get it under control by having city under siege, and then they had the military to sit on each block, and it saved a lot of lives. I'm trying to figure out how we take our military to other countries to protect them. And we don't have the military here to save lives in the District of Columbia.
That's a really interesting question. Mr. Chairman, your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of respect for the caller. She said she's been a victim of gun violence, has lived through some rough times in the district in the 80s, But I don't think the solution of putting the military on the streets is the right one. What we've seen is actually when the police over-police, that crime gets worse. That's not a very good way of reducing violent crime.
Hold on, T. Let him make his point. Go right ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Forever holding on, but okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
You can let her respond.
Okay, T. He's going to let you talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, not necessarily like all of the military, but back in the 80s, we used to have the military tank that sat out. I don't know how they arranged it, but the tank was set there for a week, and there was no problems. No one got hurt by gun violence or anything. I don't know what that program was, but it worked.
You know, I'm reminded that Ike Forward, who was the chief of police back in the 80s, and he passed away about 5 years ago, but before he died, he was the chair of the parole commission, so he was still active in the public safety sphere, and he would say he regretted how the police tried to wrest their way out of the crack epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s. He thought that was counterproductive, and I have to say I agree. There were some other strategies. There were roadblocks that were set up, I remember, in Trinidad, and that was taken to court and struck down as unconstitutional. We can over-police, and that will be counterproductive. I think the police working with the community, not as an occupation force, but actually as a partner with the community, can be much more productive. And research has shown that strategies like that can be very successful in reducing gun violence.
And let me say, You know. However briefly, your concerns, T, are very, very valid. But I know that activists in communities in the district would oppose that. We have seen these kinds of concerns about, as the chairman is saying, about over-policing, the militarization of communities of color with armored vehicles, which does not minimize concerns like yours of the rise of deadly gun violence and the like. And trying to find a balance is exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. It is a very difficult situation. It is indeed a conundrum and something that may not have just one fix. But thank you for your patience and allowing me to take your phone call. I appreciate your thoughtful question. Let's go to Allison. Allison, calling from D.C., what's on your mind? Allison, are you there? Allison, give me a call back if you can. Let me go to the next issue. Today, President Biden said that it's likely that they will be announcing that federal government workers will be required to be vaccinated before they can, can return to work. The CDC recommending masks. We are seeing a huge rise in COVID infections because of the Delta variant and the like. What is your biggest concern about the rise of COVID infections in the district? I mean, it's happening everywhere, but certainly as we're talking about COVID in the district, what's your biggest concern now as far as, policy and, perhaps the return of emergency orders, how it may affect businesses and the like?
Well, I am concerned about the trend. The numbers are going up in the district, although the numbers are still low. If I remember correctly, right now, around 7 out of 100,000 people. That's the rate of infection in the district.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the winter, it was closer to 50 per 100,000. So it's quite low by comparison, but it has been going up. What the experts are saying is that this is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. I'm going to repeat that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Over half of our population has been fully vaccinated. That's not enough. But it should say to those who are unvaccinated for whatever reason that the vaccine is safe. I think the number is close to 900,000 doses have been administered in the district. Now, that's not 900,000 individuals, but 900,000 doses. And we don't have reports of people dying from the vaccine, being hospitalized because of the vaccine. To be sure, a very small fraction across the country, yes, but overwhelmingly, the statistics bear out that the vaccine is safe and that it is effective. And the people who are not vaccinated are at risk to themselves of ending up in the hospital and dying, just to overstate it a little bit, but or rather to state it rather dramatically. But that is the risk. And the more people that get infected, because we are seeing the numbers going up, the greater the chance of a new variant that could become even more lethal, that could be a danger to people who are already vaccinated. From a public health perspective, that is what is best for the most of us, the most of people in our city, is people getting vaccinated. And that's why I'm making the point. People need to get vaccinated.
Where are we with respect to the moratorium on evictions in the district right now? There's been so much back and forth about that with, you know, landlords and and renters.
Well, when the pandemic started, March of 2020, the council adopted a moratorium on evictions, period. We loosened it a little bit, but we adopted legislation a couple weeks ago that will transition to it ending. For now, there cannot be any evictions. Beginning around October 12th, eviction cases can resume. However, landlords cannot seek to evict for non-payment of rent unless they can demonstrate to the court that an application for relief for rental assistance has been filed through one of the many programs, the biggest of which is Stay DC. So if people, tenants who are in arrears on their rent, look up, go to the DC government website, look up Stay DC, apply to Stay DC, you can get thousands and thousands of dollars paid toward your rent, your back rent. And if you do that, you'll be protected from eviction beyond October 12th.
Is that process as cumbersome as it is reputed to be? The mayor?
No.
I know that earlier, I remember, you know, last year when there were federal dollars that had been disseminated, and the mayor was saying that she was extremely concerned about losing that money unless it had been spent, and that the process was so cumbersome that people weren't doing it.
The process is not as cumbersome as it's reputed to be because a number of steps have been taken to make it easier. It is not as easy as it should be. And I continue to press, and the council a couple weeks ago adopted some legislation seeking to require the mayor to make it easier, because the goal here is to get as many people to get that assistance as possible. The average payout is over $7,000. It'll pay back rent, and it will pay up to 3 months in advance forward rent. So it's quite generous. It's federal money. $350 million came to the city for this. That's just for rent. There's a separate money that's available for mortgage assistance, and I don't know the details of that program. But so not only is it advantageous to a tenant to apply to Stay DC to get the rent paid, and in fact, the tenant can go to their landlord and have their landlord apply, and all that the tenant has to do is just sign a consent. So in that sense, it would be even easier for tenants. Not only do they get their debt paid, but they're protected from eviction.
I want to also discuss the situation with vacant housing and you know, the D.C. Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs. And this is why, you know, from one perspective, and you know, this is not a secret. I live in Baltimore, and so the issue of vacant housing in Baltimore is, in a word, notorious. D.C. not as bad, but yet there it still has its issues. What is your perspective on the vacant housing issue in the district? Because it, you know, on one hand, there is vacant housing, but on the other hand, D.C. remains one of the most expensive cities in the nation to live.
Yes. Well, I recently had in my newsletter a focus on three apartment buildings that are vacant. And representing, I think, if I remember correctly, several hundred possible units that could be on the market right now for renters, helping with our housing shortage. One of them is a large building that's off of New Hampshire Avenue, northeast near Eastern Avenue. The city has a tax structure that taxes vacant property at a higher rate as an incentive to get property owners to put the property back in use. The problem is that DCRA, the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, which is responsible for inspecting and classifying properties as vacant, is not doing a good job. And so what I have found repeatedly is that there are buildings that are vacant that DCRA knows are vacant, and yet they're not being taxed as if they were vacant. The difference in the property tax can be substantial. I remember for one property, it was a larger property and therefore more valuable. The difference between the lower rate and the vacant property tax rate was well over $100,000 a year. And these properties, some of these properties have been vacant for a decade, two decades, or longer. And the goal here is to get them back into use. And the real property tax, the vacant property tax, is a financial means to do that, and DCRA is dropping the ball.
Why do you believe that is the case? Why do you think that DCRA is dropping the ball, as you say?
Because I think DCRA is too big. It was formed 30 years ago out of maybe a half dozen different offices and agencies. The idea being that consolidating all these functions would make it more efficient. And in fact, DCRA has struggled for the last 30 years because it hasn't been able to do its work well. So we see this not just with vacant property, but with housing code inspections, enforcement against illegal construction. And it's a reason why I moved legislation a year ago. The council approved to break up the agency and create a smaller Department of Buildings. They would be focused exclusively on housing code compliance, construction code compliance, and vacant property enforcement.
Okay, so, but that hasn't happened.
Correct. Well, the bill was passed last December. The mayor vetoed it. The council overrode the veto. The bill is now funded. We just funded it with the budget that's before us. So beginning October 1st, the city administrator will have to begin the transition planning. It'll take about a year, but we'll transition to two separate agencies.
So here's my question. And again, I look at the situation from the perspective of Baltimore. A Department of Buildings where you have so many vacant buildings, you would literally need an army of inspectors. And indeed, you would need a Department of Buildings in the district that would likely need to become as large as DCRA is now to handle the problems. Am I overstating that?
If we're talking about only vacant buildings, mm-hmm. I think you're overstating it.
Okay.
Because a vacant building, you know, as long as it's vacant, it's vacant. And so if we're talking about classifying, there are roughly 3,500 vacant properties in the city. vacant buildings. If you're talking about starting from scratch, yes, that would be a large task. It would take some time. But we already know most of the buildings, and so much of the department is inefficient. There's a townhouse on Capitol Hill, and I mention this because it's notorious. It's been vacant for at least 20 years. It's so notorious that some of the neighbors have started a Twitter account. It's like 1,000 Feet Street Northeast. And the department has changed the task classification 31 times in the last 10 years. They're spending a lot of time on that building, and it still isn't being taxed as if it was vacant. They spent a lot of time, send an inspector out, says it's vacant, supervisor overrules, inspector goes back out. They could be much more efficient.
Wow. So much work to do here in the district.
That's government. Life.
Yes, indeed. Council Chair Phil Mendelson, thank you so much for talking to us this evening.
You,
I appreciate
thank
your
you
time.
To all the listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of work to do, particularly in the area of public safety, specifically this deadly gun violence and police. It's still my home. Still worried about it. My parents are here, so I've got a lot of work to do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, July 27th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.